By the way, have you noticed that...
Shelley, are we good?
Well, of course, but Representative Boyle makes it on time in the afternoon.
Well, but she's going to leave early, so...
She's making up for it. Okay. What am I thinking?
Good afternoon. We'll call to order the House Committee on Business and Labor for February 15, 2012. Today, we are here for one purpose, which is an informational meeting on the proposed revisions to Oregon Liquor Control Commission retail store rules. We have several people who are on the list to speak to that today, and we'll start with Mr. Steve Farrow, Executive Director of LLCC, and we'd like to hear, come forward and please give us an overview. It'll be maybe repetitive in part, but help us kick off this discussion by just outlining what exactly the proposed rule changes are and the timetable for those.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And what we were talking about before was two specific rules with regards to changes to the retail arm of the commission. And before I get going into those two rules, I just wanted to go ahead and briefly sort of outline how we came about establishing those rules to give you some greater perspective on things. In early 2010, then Chair Phil Lang put together a committee and appointed several members to a committee to actually look at certain options for modernization. And within that committee, you had one commissioner, you had, I'm looking at the list now, the committee appointments. You had five that were selected from the distilled spirits industry, five members from the grocery industry, one from the wholesale industry, two from the legislature or legislative offices, five from the liquor agents themselves, three OLCC staff, and two from public safety. So this committee was actually put together to explore different options within the purview of the commission's rules and responsibilities to try and move the commission forward in terms of modernization. What they came up with was a four rules package. And I will say the members, some chose to attend the meeting, some chose not to attend the meeting, but ultimately what came out of that committee was a package of four rules. Two of the rules have been passed already, so they're already in place. And the two rules that I believe that you want to talk about today are the first one, which is with regards to business opportunities for corporations becoming liquor agents. And then the second one is the expansion of related items for the retail stores under a current or under a business plan that they would put together that would allow them to sell beer and wine. So I also need to go ahead and give you a little perspective that'll, I think, shed some light on those two particular rules. And you have to keep these things in mind. We have two type of stores in the state. They're called exclusive and non-exclusive. An exclusive agency is one that has certain sales of a certain amount, and that exclusive agency sells and gets their revenue primarily from the sale of distilled spirits. They have within what we would call a list of related items, opportunities to sell other items, such as mixers, whatever other things we may have on that list. Then you have a non-exclusive section of agents, and those are ones that primarily have other businesses or they have other businesses associated with the liquor business. For instance, we have 53 agents of the 94 of all the agents, the 246 agents we have in the state, 94 are non-exclusive. Of those 94 non-exclusive agents, there's actually a total of 53 that have grocery stores or have convenience stores and carry distilled spirits. There are three stores within the Portland metro area that are actually the exclusive stores that are within other stores, other grocery stores. So you have to remember that we already have a bifurcated system that allows for sale of beer and wine in some selected stores. And also in those same stores, they can also sell a lot of other products. Then we have in the exclusive stores, we have just primarily distilled spirits with a list of related items. So the two rules that we're looking at are not, in my opinion, significant deviations from what we already do. I would say they are more of a permutation or change of a way to become more modern in terms of how we approach the opportunity for businesses out there, and that's the primary basis for this committee that was put together in 2010. So now I'll go over the two rules in a little bit more detail. Currently, within the process, whether you're an exclusive agent or whether you have an exclusive agency or a non-exclusive agency, we essentially make a contract with an individual. That's an individual that is responsible per that contract to go ahead and conduct all the business, to make all the sales, to be accountable for the inventory, et cetera. With the within that process, we do have, within the Portland area, three, and did have four stores at one point, where you had an individual with a contract with us, but they actually existed as an exclusive store within a grocery store. So they existed already within a grocery store. In fact, in two cases that I can remember specifically, two of the members that had those exclusive stores within the grocery store were actually members of the store staff. So as I referred to earlier, it's an individual that has a contract. So within the two stores that I can remember in particular, I think they were both produce managers that worked for that particular grocery store. They came forward, proposed, they were supported by that grocery business. And then they were selected based upon the competition that was there, and they had an opportunity then to open up a store within a store, so to speak. So they had an exclusive store within a grocery store. Okay, so the one rule with regard to corporations essentially removes that facade. Currently, what would have to happen is, as I said, you'd have to have, if you wanted to have it within a Fred Meyer store, so to speak, you would have to have a produce manager, a meat manager, somebody like that that would come forward, would put together the proposal, and I'm sure with support from the grocery store, would put together that proposal, then come forward and compete with other individuals that would be wanting to get a liquor store within that area. But where there has been problems in the past is many of those large corporations do not want to have just an individual that would come forward and put in for that liquor store. It's basically our understanding that they would want to be able to have it represented by a corporate entity, so to speak. And so one of the rules that we're looking at, instead of requiring to have a specific individual within that grocery store, the corporation would be able to sign up for that and actually compete based upon that permutation of the rule, that it's the corporation and not a particular individual.
Historically, what's been the reason for having it be with an individual versus a corporate entity?
Mr. Chair, the reason, of course, we've been around for almost 80 years now, so there were certain reasons they started out back then, but I think generally there was a sense, as they came under prohibition, that they did not want to go ahead and have corporations, so to speak, begin getting back into the game that they had had problems with prior to prohibition. So my understanding would be is that they wanted to limit the ability of the stores to become huge conglomerations.
Okay. Thank you.
The second rule that we would be talking about is the ability for exclusive liquor stores to sell beer and wine. Currently, as I described, there's two types of liquor stores, a non-exclusive. The non-exclusive generally is in more rural areas or in smaller towns. Since it's non-exclusive, most of those stores already sell beer and wine. So you have to set that aside. Now you come to the exclusive stores that are generally more in a metropolitan or larger towns. They generally have higher sales, and they generally are defined by primarily distilled spirits sale and some related items. What we are looking at is based upon a business plan and the proposal that would come from an exclusive agent, they then would be able to carry beer and wine. So to speak, that if there was an exclusive agency that was three streets back of the main thoroughfare through a town, and they wanted to move to a better location, they would be able to possibly move to a better location because they would be able to support themselves by being able to sell beer and wine along with distilled spirits. So it gives them an avenue to get additional revenue, which would help with modernization and moving forward. Those are basically the two rules as they're now laid out. And those would be the objectives, to go ahead and modernize, create additional revenue so that the liquor store agents would be able to move to better locations, provide greater service, and also the corporations now could, being totally controlled by the commission, would still be able to go ahead and submit for an agency. And I also want to state that the commission would be very careful in terms of the number of grocery stores that we would probably allow within the system. That sort of sums it up.
Okay. Before we go to questions, could I ask you just to say again, what was the makeup of the committee that looked at this? You went through it, but I didn't get all the
Sure. Mr. Chair, there was one commissioner. There were five appointees from distilled spirits industry. There were five appointed from the grocery industry. There was one wholesaler. There were two from the legislature or legislative staff. There were five liquor agents. There were three OLCC staff and two public safety members.
Okay. Chair.
Appreciate you coming today. And I guess probably it'd be helpful if I shared some of my perspective as the co-chair of the committee that has some substantial responsibility for liquor policy. And the other day I had a nice conversation with one of the other representatives about we're about policy, not management. And I thought that was a good discussion, and then I tried to draw the line. That was funny. But anyhow, I guess to me it seems that, am I accurate in assuming that some of the efforts at this point are partially in response to Washington's Costco initiative and the whopping $22 million, or is this just an accumulation of what's been happening?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Kenemer, this is actually a move by the Commission to constantly be looking at how it can modernize and do things better. Mm-hmm. It's been brought up before that, well, this is in reaction to 1183. Yep. That's not the case. We started the conversation within the staff probably good 3 years ago, and as you can see from the date when we started the committee, which was in 2010, it was before that. So I think what happens over time, our perspective is you have to constantly be leaning forward and looking at ways to stay in the marketplace and do what the customers need to have done to better support them. So this is a natural evolution, as I would put it, not revolutionary, but evolutionary. We will constantly be going it, and this will not be where it stops. We will constantly be looking at how we can do things better.
Mr. Chair, second question, follow-up. I guess it's another question. How much latitude do you think? We have, in my view, rather antiquated statutes that, at least as I understand, were originally cobbled together trying to deal with prohibition, and that's their origins principally. How do those work in terms of modern flexibility and the latitude that you need to deliver on your mission?
Co-Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Kenemer, the statutes themselves, I think, based upon my knowledge of the statutes, are probably okay. The rules, which are important, how we operate, those have specific guidelines in terms of how you have to approach when you want to make those changes. And they can take from 6 to 9 months. So, for instance, we wanted to, as one of the four rules that came out of this committee, one was to set up satellite stores. And we were already working with the coastal community where we had an agency to do a satellite store. So even though from a operational standpoint, we can be thinking about how much better it is and can be done, you still have to, in many cases, go down the path of the rules in order to formally go through that process. And it depends upon how you make the rule. If the rule is relatively crafted narrow, then you have to make several changes over several years. If it is not crafted so narrowly, we can have more flexibility. So, for instance, in crafting the latest satellite store rule, it is crafted with a little bit more latitude because we recognize business changes very quickly, customers' interests change very quickly, and we may need to move a little bit faster than in the past.
So you think you have some latitude in doing that?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Kenemer, yes, we do.
Okay. Further questions? Thanks for being here. I'd like to ask if you'd stick around, because
absolutely,
Mr. Chair. We'll have some other testimony.
Chairman, if I could, to just, sure. I guess, one more comment. You know, okay. I think the chair and I and others have been discussing, too, you know, what role this committee needs to play in this discussion, and also in what I think is probably a political arena that's likely evolving with Costco's effort up north, if that's got implications here for others, and some people have said it does, some have questioned that, I don't know. That's why we wanted to do an informational hearing and see at what level this committee would look at getting involved. We are thinking about maybe doing a task force and working forward from there.
Mr. Chair, co-chair.
I just want to be straight up.
Mr. Chair, co-chair Kenmer, I fully understand. I think there's certainly a lot of controversy that has come out with the passage of 1183. There's a constant, review that takes place within the commission, how we can do things better to stay up with where we need to be. And when you're trying to take care of the public and do the best you can, I agree with you. There also has to be a lot of constant conversation beyond just what we do.
Okay. Thanks again, Mr. Farrell. We'll hear next from Joe Gilliam, please.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam. I'm the president of the Northwest Grocery Association. Thank you for inviting me to come down and testify and talk about this subject matter. We are in opposition to the rules that you're talking about, but not just, not just basically on the face of the rules, but it is because the rules themselves are kind of nibbling around the edges when the system itself needs to be changed on a much larger scale. And it's starting to do, I think, more damage than good in the system, the way the rules are coming out right now. The issues have been around a long time. Steve and I have talked about them before. We spent a lot of time at OLCC. We work well with the agency. It's not the issue. But they're trying to work within a framework that is very old and, quite frankly, does not match today's marketplace. When we talk about modernization of a system, it's pretty tough to modernize it when you're using the same old parameters and the same old boundaries. Quite frankly, I think the system is the fax machine in a Facebook world. You can continue to work on the fax machine and try to get it to work a little faster. It's still going to be a fax machine. Things change. The current system that the OLCC operates under they're state mandated. Their boundaries are set by statute, so they're doing what they're supposed to do within the statute. The bigger question is, can you call modernization if you change a few rules and then try to go forward? I don't think you're doing any good service. And what it does, it's going to heighten the political pressure around wholesale change in the system. Representative Kenmer brought up, the issue of the state of Washington. And sure, it is putting pressure on the states around, and there's 17 states left that are state-run, similar to this system. But it's a small minority out of 50. And so there is pressure because the marketplace has changed.
You said 17?
17 left.
Including us?
Including you. Seven of those are fully controlled states where they have state employees running stores and employed doing that. So those are the most closed states. Idaho is one of those states. Washington is the next, Oregon is the next state, kind of the next stage towards open state, in being that you're using liquor agents who are not employees of the state, and going that route. Outside of that, you have fully private systems where the state's involved in enforcement and regulation, licensing. And that's one of the issues you have to get to. What is the primary role of government in this issue? And what you found in Washington was the voters very strongly did not think the state's role was to be in the sale and promotion, but felt very strongly about the state's role in regulation and enforcement. And that's the choice that was made up in the state north to us. So the rules themselves that are coming out right now, we've talked a long time about corporate. Why can't a corporation have a license to sell liquor? They have licenses to sell beer and wine. And you have to start understanding there used to be this kind of feeling there was some kind of magic between the power of distilled spirits and the lesser power of beer and wine. And science will tell you that's just not true. If you drink a 5-ounce glass of wine or have a shot of whiskey, you have just consumed the same amount of alcohol. And if you're worried about social woes that go along with that, you should be just as concerned about a glass of wine, 12-ounce beer, or a shot of whiskey. But that's old thinking, is that there's some magic between the two. And you won't find any data or any science or any studies out there will show you that there's some correlation between those social ills. But that's a policy decision that needs to be discussed. Because in the 30s, it was very much thought of that way, and that's what you're really operating under. So as you go forward, the idea of a corporation, whether there's some idea that the makeup of a business is somehow commensurate with the safe public safety of selling alcohol, seems a little bit silly at this point in the modern day. If a corporation is responsible enough to sell beer and wine, aren't they responsible enough to sell distilled spirits? It goes on in stores all over the state already. But it only, what this proposes is, yeah, we'll give you a corporate license, but only some of you will have access to selling distilled spirits. And we will regulate you and say, you guys all compete for a license. So let's say Beaverton Hillsdale Highway. We call it Murderer's Row because there's so many grocery stores on it. 8 grocery stores are going to compete for one license. Now, where's the fairness in that? They all sell beer and wine. They're all approved by the OLCC. They all have licenses that are a privilege to have by the state, but only one's going to get it. But on the other side of the ledger, we're going to pass a rule that allows you to sell beer and wine in all the liquor stores. Not, they don't have to compete for that license to sell beer and wine. All of them will get it. Why? Because they're looking at that as modernization.
So let me ask you, the first part of that, you said there's 8 grocery stores in a row going to compete for one license. We didn't really hear much about how that's going to come to be. How are these grocery stores going to be given a license to sell liquor?
Distilled spirits, yes, liquor. Mr. Chair, as I understand it, there'd be, if in an area, and I don't know if Beaverton Hillsdale would be one of them, I'm just using it as an example of grocery stores, but if you pick an area and say, okay, we're going to allow this store in a store concept and we're going to give one license, the grocery stores in that area would all have to compete for that one license based on geography. Now that means you have to buy into a principle that somehow that geography and population is a effective means of control of public safety for liquor distribution. Now, in other states across this country, you won't find any data that backs that up.
That is our current policy.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
I just was going to point out, but that is our current policy, or the rules allow us to allocate licenses on the basis of geography and population. And as a result, in Mr. Gilliam's example, those 8 stores could not all qualify.
They could not qualify.
Probably okay. One. It depends on probably a little more complicated than that, but it's pretty good illustration of how the current system works. And then, of course, you raise the issue of is that fair?
So to be clear, that's the new rule proposal we heard about was to allow the liquor agents to sell beer and wine. What you're talking about is the current policy of allowing a store within a store, largely in rural areas.
Two separate things. One, for the grocery store retailers, you'd have to go through this process of competing for a license. So only one grocery store in an area would get it. Maybe you have 8 grocery stores or 4 grocery stores, right. But only one would get it. The other rule is existing liquor stores that already have licenses to sell distilled spirits would all get beer and wine.
But the former is not a new rule, is it? That's current rule, is that we can have these stores within a store.
It's been a pilot project. They did 4, and then it sat for a while, and now it's back.
Okay.
It's not the norm. It's, you know, Mr. Chair, it's in one way it's not the norm in this, like the city of Portland or in a large populated area where they usually do the exclusive stores. The rural stores are usually the store in a store model, like the Sun River store. That's, people seem to know that one the best, where you go in and then there's a separate purchase area in a little cordoned off area, and you sell out of a little window. So that's taking that, modifying it, and maybe putting it in Portland to have a store in a store, but only one of the stores could get it. My point is, on the flip side, all liquor stores suddenly get beer and wine.
Right, I understand.
Now, that is modernization for the liquor store owners, because they're kind of looking at it going, well, why can't we sell beer and wine if we're allowed to sell, distilled spirits? We already have a license for that. Why can't we sell that? And there's always been this dividing line between, well, stores get beer and wine, liquor stores get liquor, and that's how we're going to keep it. The sheet I gave you is, I want to say this. So Steve Farrow and staff, they're operating within the rules that they've been given and the laws they've been given. So this is not an end run or some nefarious deal. This is the system in which they're operating under. That's the rules. My point is this, is the rules need to change and the laws need to change. And it needs to be a broad policy discussion because these things are going to start turning territories and people against each other and all this kind of stuff that normally work together on stuff, because you're not really looking at the system holistically. What does a modern system look like? And it's much broader than that. We think a modern system should be in the private market. If you're a grocery store that has a beer and wine license, you ought to be able to sell distilled spirits as well. We don't think the state should be in the business of wholesaling or promoting or selling. We think the current liquor stores should be grandfathered in and allowed to sell beer, wine, hot dogs, or anything else they want to sell and become part of regular business. That you don't need the old prohibitions that came out of prohibition in order to have a safe and sane state. And that's really what you saw happen in the state of Washington. They nibbled around the edges for years. They caused great divides between sectors of the industry until one retailer finally said, we've had enough, and the other retailers jumped on board. And by the way, the number's 19 million, not 22, because it tends to grow each time the story gets told.
Well, it's a better story. But I appreciate the correction. I'll try to get it right.
Yeah. The state of Washington. Yeah.
No. 22 would have been too expensive.
22 is too much.
Yeah.
Okay. 19 to 14, by the way. So it got to a point where it was a boiling point, and so the state was then taken out of the game in terms of setting policy. And the policy was set, quite frankly, by the retail community who wanted to write it and get done and modernize the system. So the state kind of abdicated its position in the role because it locked down to the old system so long. It just said, we're not gonna move, and dug a trench.
But if I may, excuse me. Yeah, and I think also it was one selective part of the market that sort of dictated how this change came about. And in fairness, with proportionate benefits likely attached. What I'm trying to say is that it favored the big box markets over, we have the small distillers and the craft beer people and all of those. And I think my guess is that in the long run, those are going to be the losers under that system because they weren't part of the discussion.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I think it could have gotten better for them. I don't think it's going to, do great harm to them. But
why?
The market is going to change. There's going to be opportunities for small distillers to go directly to retailers. They'll have a choice. They could sign up with a distributor and have an exclusive with a distributor that might market their product well, or they might go to a retailer who have an exclusive with a retailer who might market the product as well, and have access to where they want to go. So it opens up the old three-tier system that said it had to be retailer to distributor to manufacturer is now opened up into a modern market where there are both, and they have to compete, and it's a free market. I mean, this goes on with all sorts of products every day in the market, whether they're small companies, cookie companies, cereal companies, doesn't matter what it is. This goes on every day with about 60,000 other SKUs in every grocery store. So this is not like we're creating some new fantastic experiment. It's actually the open market. So we'll see up there. I think it could have been a better product had people come to the table. But when you have people say, we're dead set against you because you're gonna change an old system, then people write what they're gonna write.
Representative Hoyle had a question.
So my background is in distribution, retail and wholesale manufacturing distribution, and I think I heard you say earlier something like to the effect, and I'm not sure if I heard you right, so maybe clarify that making decisions on where to sell a product, on geography or population, is not something that you think is commonplace or a good thing, because I know that when I would choose who was going to distribute a certain product, and I worked for very small companies and large companies, and we would always look at, was there other competition in the area, what was the market saturation, how many things could we sell, should we sell, who should get which brand, and at the end of the day, it is much easier for a large company, a large name brand company that has access to national marketing money and sales reps, much easier for them to get shelf space, higher shelf space, better shelf space access than some of our small cottage industry distributors like we have here in Oregon. I mean, it is one of the best business increases that we've had are our small liquor that small independent liquor
micro-distilleries.
Micro-distilleries. So that's important. The other thing is, I spent most of my life, half my life in New Hampshire, which is a state that also they have all of their liquor is sold through state stores. They also have no sales tax. Oregon and New Hampshire are the only two states without any kind of a sales tax. And I kind of think that, you know, we're not out of step with the rest of the country. The rest of the country's out of step with us. I think things are going just fine. I haven't heard that there's a lack of access to alcohol. And I think that it is a substance that should be controlled in some way. And again, I appreciate the proposals that have been brought forward, and I appreciate your concerns. But I would be very reluctant to change the system we have, both because of the impact that we would have on local jobs and our businesses, because of the impact of potentially rising prices. I mean, there have been stories written in Washington about how the price of liquor has been increasing, and again, I just think we have a system that works fairly well for Oregon, and I think represents our values.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to take Representative Hoyle as a no. Right now,
I'm leaning that way.
Genius is a precious commodity.
She hasn't heard your rebuttal yet.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, to the stories about the rising price of liquor in Washington, if it's rising today, it's because it's a state-run system, because the new system hasn't taken effect. What you're mostly reading are stories of just projecting, most of those planted by the opposition, who are suing the state over the privatization. There are no prices set yet. So anything you see on pricing the state of Washington is just is guesses at best, and they're just press stories that are being planted. So please don't take those. There's no trend in prices. In terms of the population issue, I think it's really the question you asked me. The point is, I think the vendor, the people that you used to work for, should make the decision where they set their products and where they think they can sell the most products, like you said. The state now says, regulates location by population, not the private market, not the distiller or the supplier of that product. They don't decide, I'd like to do better in Bend versus Cay Falls, and then make free market decisions on how much product they ship or what they do in those areas. They currently just have to go through the state, they sell it to the warehouse, and then it's sent out to those stores. We don't think that is a modern system. We don't think that reflects the consumer choices and serving our customers. This really isn't an argument about access. You know, we have to have more access to alcohol. Somehow, Oregonians are starving. They don't have enough alcohol. Oh, my God.
I haven't heard that. And, you know, among my colleagues, I certainly haven't seen that.
No. And I'm going to not do a joke like my brother would right now and just leave it alone. It is how do you deliver it, not so much. It's not about increasing the volume of it, but it is how you deliver it to the modern consumer. Where does the modern consumer go? One of the arguments on one of the rules is to put beer and wine in liquor stores to help the liquor store sell more. It'd be more convenient for their customers to be able to stop in and get liquor and beer and wine at the same stop, be a revenue enhancement for those liquor stores, help them out in what they make. Well, the same argument is true on the other side. If you had liquor available in grocery stores where we sell beer and wine, it would be far more convenient for the consumer to not have to stop at a small liquor store and go get their distilled spirits. People shop much differently in 2012 than they did in 1933, and we have not changed the system to reflect that pretty much over the whole time. So I'm not here to criticize OLCC or tell them they're doing something, like I say, something, you know, sneaky or underhanded. I'm just saying that the two rules really don't get at the issue of modernization. They just don't get at the policies that I think you should be discussing on the broad base. We would like to have a broad-based discussion of policy and modernizing the system. These are the principles we'd bring to the table. And we think that we could get a good product if we had an open discussion about it. What will happen eventually is if we'll just repeat what happens in Washington. I don't know how much time it would take, but if everybody's going to lock down, dig their foxhole and say, well, it can't change because we've always done it this way, then someone will do it for you. And that's the power of the initiative. And I'll just tell you, it was a 30-year deal in Washington. It was basically 30 years of pent-up pressure, and finally enough was enough, and they got what they got. I think the system will be fine in Washington. We supported it. I think it'll ultimately be good, and good for the independent retailers, and good for distributors as well. And they're up in arms about it. But I think when it all evens out, it's going to be fine. And I think the state of Washington is going to be about $485 million ahead in the first 6 years in their pocket by getting rid of their overhead.
Follow up. So would that be, but that's an estimation, much like you say, I mean, there's a Seattle Times article that says that it looks like liquor prices to go up over fees from Initiative 1183, and you said that's a supposition on their part. Do you think that those numbers you just gave us are a supposition on your part? I mean, maybe they will, maybe they won't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, that is a supposition on the part of their financial management office in the state of Washington. Those are their numbers, not ours. So that's what they're predicting. I think it's going to be higher, but I don't want to get out on that limb. I'll use their numbers. And, you know, the state's cut, let's just take the pricing issue out of it. The state's cut's still going to see savings. Doesn't matter what the price is. In fact, if the price does go up, the state will make more, because the licensing fees are based on gross sales for distributors and for retailers. So if let's say the price went up 20%, the state's going to get a piece of that as it goes up. So the state's still going to come out better in their pocket for their services and the things that they provide. They're going to have more money in their pocket. It's $86 million in the first year by cutting their overhead. So.
And then I'm not going to ask you any other questions. I really appreciate you're very informative. You're very prepared, and I certainly appreciate that. But just a comment, I think when we're having this policy discussion, we do have to look at it. And you said it: people shop in a supermarket very differently than people shop in a liquor store. You know, my daughter can work. My son can work in a supermarket before they're 21. In a liquor store, there's a limited audience and a limited group of people who can shop in a liquor store as opposed to in the supermarket. And I think as part of the policy discussion, there is a public benefit of, again, how do we control alcohol sales, make sure that we're not getting alcohol to minors, making sure that that the laws are being followed to ensure that the people that are getting access to alcohol are the ones that are legally able to get access to alcohol. So I think that public health and public interest concern should also be addressed when we're having these conversations.
Mr. Chair, I just comment that part of 1183, and this is kudos to the OLCC and their work here with the retailers, is they basically adopted the responsible vendor program that we have here as their new standard for clerk training. They didn't have a clerk training program prior to this and adopted the Oregon model into their by rule for the clerk training. And so each clerk we trained every quarter and all that. So that is a part of the overall discussion.
Yeah, and should continue to be in any changes that we make.
Absolutely. I would agree with you.
See? We can agree.
We're almost there.
Yeah, almost.
Conger, did you have a question?
More of a comment, I guess, to follow up on Representative Hoyle's conversation about New Hampshire. I had a weird experience when I lived in Massachusetts. We went up, I'd never been to New Hampshire, so we drove over the border on the highway, and there's this great big building right over the border. Mm-hmm. And I said, what the heck is that? It's really nice and everything, kind of modern looking, and it was a New Hampshire liquor store, and they did a booming business from people coming from Massachusetts where there was a sales tax, pretty significant tax, and coming over the border to New Hampshire. So I thought it was ironic because once you were in New Hampshire, I never saw another liquor store. But right by the border.
Oh, they're there. They are there.
It was, you know, it was very, I thought it was very entrepreneurial of them and you know, taking advantage of whatever price differential was there.
Ever been to Janssen Beach in the old days?
No. Got stores in Washington across the Canadian border.
But I think, so my comment really is that almost illustrates an irony. The purpose of the control over the distribution and sale of liquor is temperance. And so for New Hampshire, I felt like there was there's still an element of that with their own population, but certainly not for the poor slobs south of the border in Massachusetts. And I think it puts the state and the OLCC in a very difficult position to be both the seller, distributor, the business of the sale of liquor, but also the regulator. And I think that confusion of roles is one that, should be reconciled for the sake of the agency and the state. But the caution that I have is really to echo something, again, that Representative Hoyle already said, is that if we're going to move in that direction, this is a fairly complex and big system with a lot of businesses and consumers and business owners that are dependent on it and that already fit into that system. And so if ultimately we move from that system, I think the transition has to be very, very carefully considered. And I certainly hope that a lot of thought is given to how that's managed so that it doesn't have, real detrimental consequences for people who are in the current system and who depend on it.
In Mr. Chair, in the Washington system, because their system had some of their stores were owned by the state and run by the state, they were just closed. But the contract stores, they call contract stores, are similar to the non-exclusive stores you see in our rural areas, pretty much the same model, and those were all grandfathered in. They kept their liquor licenses and kept their businesses. So they were not eliminated in the process. Now, you'd have to look at this system very closely and find out what would be fair, because you're exactly right. You have liquor agents who have an investment in their stores, and what's fair as the system changes.
If I may follow up on that, it's not just the liquor agents, it's also the manufacturers who have an existing distribution system that they're used to working with. I mean, there's, again, we don't need to get into the details, but it strikes me that as little as I know about how the OLCC operates, I know that the scale is significant and that any transition, could impact, for example, businesses in Bend and elsewhere in the state that are used to dealing with this, and so that needs to be considered both on the supply side or the manufacturer side as well as the retail side.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot. I want to get to some other testimony. We have Paul Cosgrove. Why don't we bring you up since I know you have another appointment. So we'll hear from you, and then we should have plenty of time for the rest of our group.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. We are the manufacturers of the product we're talking about the sales of. And I have some written testimony that I will summarize quite briefly. DISCUS has worked closely with OLCC over the years and continue to do so in supporting modernization of the system. And I served on the committee that you heard described by Mr. Farrell. I was one of the members, and DISCUS supported all four proposals, the two that have been adopted and the two are still pending. We do not take a position on privatization, but we do take a position that we ought to modernize the systems, whether they be state-controlled control systems like Oregon or open systems like other states, in order to try to level the playing field somewhat between the various kinds of products. Mr. Gilliam mentioned the equality of alcohol and its effect on human beings, and I'd like to point out at the bottom of my testimony is that little logo that you've all seen in your DMV books about one drink of 1.5 ounces of distilled spirits, which is the normal pour, is the same amount of alcohol as 5 ounces of wine, is the same amount of alcohol as 12 ounces of beer. DISCUS actually developed that, and I believe at this point all 50 states actually put it in their DMV manuals for the point of pointing out to people that regardless of what we've heard in years past, we all need to know that alcohol in any form can be a problem and that there is no, as I say, we don't use the word hard liquor in our business. We use the word distilled spirits, and I always say there is no soft liquor. I mean, it's alcohol is alcohol. So we do support the modernization of the system, and we do support the four rules, the two that have been proposed and the two pending. I'd be glad to answer any questions if there are any.
Does DISCUS have among its members what we might think of as the small craft distillers, or large? Is it mostly the big players?
Mr. Chairman, originally it was always just the big players. We, in fact, within the last couple of years, and it was actually an effort that came out of the state of Oregon because this state is ahead in micro-distillery development, we have opened a new category of membership that really more fits micro-distillers and are actively recruiting micro-distillers to join in. Some have. Not all have, but some have. And we would like to be representative of the interests of all people, big and small. So not every micro-distiller by any means in Oregon as a member, we hope to change that.
All right. Representative Matthews.
Just a quick question. I think you'd be appropriate for this, but Hood River Distillery, as an example, they make vodka. Now, for the record, I'm a non-drinker. I couldn't even tell you what any of this is like, but they currently sell their product, and that's the number one product in the state of Oregon, I think, is their vodka is like one of the leading brands sold, I think, out of Hood River. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that data in front of me, but I'm sure it's one of the leading brands.
Okay, yes. So is there any concern that maybe that product would then be competing in a privatization that on other products it might be cheaper, and then maybe Hood River could be impacted significantly if we did this? I'm just asking the question because we've been doing some things. We recently had the distillery bill where Representative Harker came in, so selling distilled spirits now at point of trial, if you will. we're trying to do things for jobs and whatnot. I want to make sure that we're looking at every aspect, and yet I don't want to just slam a door shut on an idea.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, frankly, Hood River is not actually one of
Matthews. Representative Matthews, maybe.
I'm sorry.
Did you call me Schaffler?
You want to respond?
Is that a Freudian slip?
And well, you weren't,
so,
you,
my
God. You weren't
seeing a tree,
jobs.
A gravel, or any water around here.
My God, if we don't get the gravel out of here.
I apologize. Good. To the committee. Representative Matthews, especially, I apologize.
That's good. That's okay. I'm honored.
Representative Matthews, Hood River is actually not a member of DISCUS, so I can't talk about their business plans because I don't know what they are. But I can tell you it's been a pretty successful business. It's been a successful business as Oregon has moved. Most of the income growth in Oregon is not because we sell more distilled spirits. We sell more expensive distilled spirits to the people. People buy up in Oregon, and we've been successful at getting people to buy up. Some of that is micro distillery. Some of it is the big distillers. Through all of that process, and in fact, Hood River actually has some high-end brands. Hood River's done well. I expect they will continue to do well. So I think they're a very successful business, and I expect they won't be affected. Their business model has been able to moderate to work in this state and work in other states and where they sell products as well.
And, Mr. Chair, I only ask because there's a likelihood in redistricting that they could be part of my district someday. So.
Hey, what about British Columbia?
I think we're through.
Well, yeah, I expect I am through.
Thank you, Mr. Cosby.
Like a work in him.
Why don't we call up Steve Brown and Marshall Koba?
Good afternoon, Chair Garrett, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, here today representing the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to have a conversation, informational or otherwise, about our role in distilled spirit retailing in Oregon. And to let you know, that, I mean, the vast majority of time since I've been working with the ALSO group, Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon, we've spent our time in the Ways and Means Committee. Ways and Means Committee, we are a budget line item in the OLCC budget, agent compensation or store operating expense. And we've talked about, you know, our vision of modernization is the ability and for our commission, which is right now 8.88%, to be increased, which will allow these outstanding retailers the opportunity to invest in their stores, to invest in their people, to invest in their location. And we've been fighting that fight for a number of years, probably a generation, but I've been involved in it for a number of years. So it's an interesting opportunity to be in front of a different committee. But I'd like to start out by saying, hopefully on Monday, a number of you were visited by liquor agents. We had a number of them in the Capitol on Monday. And a few of the points that we wanted to make was the current system is working and working very well. And I think that it is working well. I think our consumers know where we're at. Sales are up 4.5% or $20 million in additional sales in 2011 over the previous year. $199 million was sent to the state's general fund, and a total of $350 million was sent to state and local governments to support education and human services and other vital services. This continues an annual trend of increased sales, and we're looking to surpass $1 billion in sales in the 13-15 biennium. So if nothing else today, the current system works. Secondly, the Oregon liquor stores are locally owned and operated by independent business people. We've got about 246 stores. We did a recent survey. We've got about 1,200, give or take a few, 1,200 employees employed through this system in the state of Oregon. And it's important to realize, and we get this question, I understand, and the agents tell me all the time, people coming into their stores thinking that they are state employees. We are not state employees. We receive no retirement benefits. We receive no health benefits. We are not state employees. We are local small businesses. And I think when you look at the Washington and Oregon situation, in to the extent, and I didn't see any exit polling, and I don't know what people in Washington voted for, but I know they voted 60-40 to change the system. But I would believe that some of them voted to downsize government. And up there, they did. There was about 1,000 employees in the distilled spirits when you look at the stores. And they had, as I understand it, 166 stores. State-run stores, with the state paying for the leases, the state paying for the rent, the state paying for the payroll and the health benefits and everything else. Down here, according to recent testimony, I think to this committee, there are 67 Oregon employees into the retail that are state employees. So it's not, if you're voting to change the system here to cut government, you're not doing it. This is a privately run system that works and works very well. With me is Steve Brown, and Steve is a liquor agent. He runs two stores, and he's going to make some comments specifically to the rules and maybe some other things. As far as maybe some interim activity on this, we're all in. We'd be more than happy to be part of that conversation and look forward to it. I think that the whole concept of modernization is something that we have been talking about for years. I've been involved with also, I think, for 10 years. It's gone by in a flash. And we have testified in front of the Ways and Means Committee, again, about agent compensation and an increase in the percentage time and time again. And if I may, I'd like to read a couple sentences out of my testimony from 11 and a half months ago, March 3rd, 2011. As many of you know, every successful sales organization constantly invests and educates and supports and gives incentives and works closely with their sales staff. We are concerned about the lack of investment in this very dynamic and successful system over the past decade and feel that if Oregon truly wants to continue the control state system that we currently enjoy, we must invest in the system or face the potential for others to decide our fate. The promise of the system relies upon its frontline sales agents, and we must invest to keep it viable and help it reach its promise. So if I said that 11 months ago, I think I said, you know, I probably said something very similar of the buy-in and before and the buy-in and before and the buy-in and before. And so we find ourselves here in a very unique and interesting situation. I think if you also go back to 1999, the OLCC, as we're talking about modernization and our openness to modernization, the OLCC put out a booklet, and it's sitting on a shelf somewhere. I'm sure the OLCC has it. I know I've got it. That booklet was called A Retail Business Plan for the Year 2000 and Beyond. So you remember in the year 2000, the computers were going to stop, things were going to go dark, and bad things were going to happen. And what that document talked about was better stores and better locations, better parking, a better retail experience. We've supported all of that. We've got good people in these agencies. We've got 240 each stores, 245 stores across the state, good people running them. When someone is replaced, the OLCC is doing a very good job of identifying good people to take their spot. And so, yeah, I mean, that you know, here we are, what, 12, 13 years later after that document was put on a shelf somewhere, and we're still working on implementation. But good things are happening. Sales are continuing to go up, and the system works and works well. There was a conversation with Mr. Gilliam and Representative Hoy about supposition of what might happen, and I think Mr. Gilliam, this wasn't talked about, but there was a comment about the Washington stores being grandfathered in and that they're going to do well. I think there's some comment on the come there. I think there's some disagreement about what will happen to those grandfathered stores. I think some might do okay. I think there's going to be a lot of problems for the stores, the independent operators up there that were grandfathered in. There's significant changes. The implementation hasn't happened yet. And I think we're waiting to see exactly how that plays out. But I offer to you from the liquor organization our input and our involvement if there is some interim activity, and appreciate your time today.
Steve Brown. You get this to the chair.
Yes. Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon. My name's Steve Brown, and as Marshall had said, I run the Lincoln City store, 1091, and I've opened the newest store in Salem Battle Creek, which is one of the largest stores in the state at 5,000 square feet. I'd like to reiterate what Marshall had said. The current system is working well, and we see that it's working well by our sales growth. I was also part of the Retail Enterprise Review Committee that had brought forward the four rule changes. And I'd like to touch on a couple of points on consensus that was brought forward by the group. Non-exclusive, or a store that is exclusive, such as mine, based solely on volume, wanting to go to a non-exclusive doesn't necessarily mean just to bring in beer and wine. I'll take my Lincoln City store as an example. Would I bring in beer and wine if I was allowed to go from an exclusive to a non-exclusive? As a retailer of 35 years in the business, big box store business, prior to getting in to the liquor agent, it wouldn't be to my advantage to compete with the Safeways and the Thriftways in my stores. I also see in markets that the consumer, which in retailing we always have to listen to the customer's needs and wants, their needs are not necessarily being met by the big box stores. And I will talk specifically about the micro brews, fastest growing category out there. Does the Safeway, the IGA, the Fred Meyers of the world carry the full assortment that the customer may need or want? I will tell you, as far as Oregon micro distilleries, they do not cover the potential out there. And I can also tell you that the customers are asking for it out there. So my point being is that a good retailer, if we're doing business today like we did it yesterday, we're probably going to fall behind the times, and the consumers' needs and wants aren't going to be met. Modernization is the word that has been brought up many times in my work with the OLCC. What does it mean? It means looking at new ways to do business. The state is in the retail business whether they want to be in the business or not, and it's working for them. Modernization gives you the ability to change quickly to the market. If you do that, we're going to continue to see the increased sales trends. Oregon's liquor stores are owned by small business people. I can tell you my last store cost me about $150,000 to open. I put that investment in that store to make that store the best that it could possibly be for the consumer. I would hate to see a privatization bill come before us to see my investment and my employees lose their jobs. Washington and Oregon is not an apples to apples comparison. As you would expect, I have my eyes on what's going on in Washington. And Joe's statements are very general on what the reality is going to be when 1183 comes about on June 1st. The consumer will see a bottle price that is higher than they're paying today. And the main reason for that is the 27% tax that is guaranteed to the state of Washington. The state of Washington was distributing liquor throughout the state, and nobody was paying for it. It was in the price. Washington's markup was 52%. It's an easy math equation when you end up looking at what it's going to cost the consumer with an additional tier put in the system. The state gets 27%, 17% on the bottle price. The distributor has to pay 10%. The distributor needs a markup on top of that. Most distributors need especially with their capital investment of hiring employees and equipment and everything else, I would guess from background knowledge, they're going to need 20 points. The groceries or the stores that sell it are definitely going to need 20 to 30 points also. If you add that up, it's well over the 52% that the state got. Oregon promotes its own distilleries. We have 46 distilleries that are well represented in our stores throughout the state. We have over 300 items available for our customers to choose from. We would hate to see what we know is going to happen in Washington. It was stated here that the small distillers have it better because they can go and fight for space in grocery stores. Being a big box retailer for many years, a lot of that space is already taken up, and it takes a lot of dollars to buy your space on the shelves. So thinking that a small distiller is going to be able to go to a Fred Meyer and convince them to put an item or 5 of their items, 10 of their items on that shelf with the other top 20 items that have all the money, it's not going to happen. I've been in the business. I would hate to see that happen in Oregon. Small business is what drives the economy. That's the other part of this that just really scares me, the thought of any kind of privatization coming to Oregon. Our small businesses are growing. I've been in the system for 8 years, and the quality of agent that we're getting in our stores to make that investment, they're retailers that know what they're doing and how to maximize sales. If they're maximizing sales in the state of Oregon, what that's going to equate to is more revenue for the state of Oregon. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you both. Questions?
You? Maybe a more comment. You know, it was earlier mentioned that there's been a trend of buying up. And a lot of that has to do with marketing. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the volume or the variety, rather not the volume, the variety of products. It amazes me, the varieties. I happen to be a Scotch drinker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I stopped at Costco in Hawaii some time back, and I had two choices. They were both pretty good choices, and I liked their prices, frankly. But it's a very different thing from going to our stores where you have huge varieties and have had, frankly, a good history of supporting our small distillers.
I have a 12-foot Scotch wall, and customers are amazed. And buying up, you know, if we continue the trend, again, what does it equate to? More dollars to go into the general fund, be passed down to cities and counties also.
Well, and frankly, if I also can mention, I think buying up, generally people don't drink as much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, there's some other byproducts of that.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing that point forward, because I think as we talk about the increase in sales, I mean, the reality is, in my world, increase in alcohol sales can relate an increase in violent crime, increase in domestic violence, increase in child abuse, and some of those things as well. So not putting that on your industry, not putting that on you as a small business owner, but certainly want to make sure that's part of this discussion, because if you're buying up and you're being responsible and you're drinking less, then that's great. But if you're somebody who's abusing the product and those things, then you know what, I'm not really in favor of increasing sales of alcohol in the state of Oregon.
Representative Matthews, just to kind of piggyback off your comment, over the past 7 years in my store, we're actually seeing the per bottle go down, but the average sale per customer going up. And it's not necessarily because of industry prices going up. It's really customers love our assortment, and we carry products that they don't see in their own state. Lincoln City, tourist destination, you know, they love Oregon. They chose to come to the Oregon coast to vacation. They love it when they walk into my store. I have an Oregon section, and they're buying something that they haven't seen before, and it's not that quick customer.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your testimony. We'll hear next from Paul Romain, please. Mr. Romain.
I don't know. I got up here. Everybody ignored me, and one ran out. So I just
actually, I know some of their schedules, and I wouldn't take it personally. But
but in your case, you probably should.
I think you may be onto something, Paul.
Yeah. Next time, I'll take a bath. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors. But I'm actually not. Because this is not, I lobby for the beer and wine distributors, but I'm sort of morphing into a different role here intentionally. I've been fortunate enough, I'm an attorney, as most of you know, and I've been fortunate enough to be around the distilled spirits and beer and wine industry for a long time. Started basically inadvertently in 1977 when I was the chief deputy AG, and we were investigating the Liquor Control Commission at that time. For some malfeasance, if you would. Files somehow got caught in drawers and never seen again. And things happened. The director the then administrator left, and there was a reshuffling, and other folks were brought in to redo the thing, and I was brought in from the Attorney General's office to help write rules and regulations. So I've been around it for a while. I started representing the beer and wine distributors back in 83. And I've been fortunate enough to be involved in a lot of different cases around the country, one of them in Washington State, which was the Costco case. Representative Garrett knows it because his firm was on the other side of the case at the time. But Costco sued the state of Washington, and I was hired by the Washington distributors to lead their litigation team against the Costco and aligned with the state. So I have a lot of familiarity with what's going on up there and what has gone on up there. A couple of clarifications here. And again, I'm not trying to represent the beer and wine distributors on this because we have a sort of a weird position on this thing, and I'll get to that in a second. First of all, some clarifications. The Costco initiative, or as it's called in Washington State, 1183, is in court. And the argument is scheduled for March 2nd in Cowlitz County, and the issue is whether the initiative covered more than one subject, because Washington State also has a provision like Oregon that an initiative cannot cover but a single subject. And there is, it's a very good case. I can't predict where it will come out, but there is I believe a likelihood that you may not have an initiative up there. They may be starting from scratch. Now, is that
going to be scheduled for any kind of expedited resolution, or will it just be on the normal course for the court to resolve?
Mr. Chair, I'm not handling the case, so I don't know. But my guess is if there is a ruling, there will be an expedited appeal because they have a very short time frame, and a lot of things can happen that are almost irreversible. If the state gets out of the distilled spirits business, that's a pretty drastic step to try and get them back into this distilled spirits business. Having said that, let me kind of tell you, this is my own personal feeling, is that you're going to have privatization in Washington State. It may not look like the 1183, but there is going to be privatization. The voters spoke pretty authoritatively, pretty forcefully, try a different word. No water in my mouth, and tongue gets large at this time.
It's after four, too.
Yes, it's after four. There's no other thing in my mouth either that would help lubricate it a little more. So Washington State will probably, you'll be dealing with a state to your north that will privatize. The problem with, or from a distributor standpoint, one of the problems with the initiative up in Washington State is it was eventually crafted pretty much by one entity, Costco. And greatly favors Costco over everybody. There's one particularly onerous provision in there where distributors have to pay into this pool. It's about $150 million. But Costco can actually be a distributor, but it's not called being a distributor for Costco. It's called retail-to-retail sales, where they would actually sell from one retailer to on-premise locations, restaurants, be able to actually deliver the wine to those places and spirits. And the distributors have to pay into this pool, but Costco doesn't. And in fact, they're competing with the distributors. So there's a lot of provisions in there that were sort of one-sided that kind of questionable. The reason I'm saying this is that you need to engage in the discussion on privatization. You can't let it happen to you. There were, contrary to Mr. Gilliam's remarks, there were people at the table who had concerns about privatization, how it's done, and actually were in favor of privatization. Some distributors were up there, actually up there, some of the larger distributors. And they wanted privatization, they just wanted it in a little different fashion than the main funder of this initiative wanted it. They couldn't come to an agreement, so one ran off with the measure that passed. A year prior, there were two competing measures on, actually one sponsored by a distributor group and one sponsored by Costco, and both of them ended up failing. So going forward, you need to deal with this issue. A couple of kind of basics that you sort of got but don't really have and you'll learn about over the year. First of all, this is a wonderful goose that lays a great golden egg for you. You get this egg on the money that comes in from distilled spirit sales. You're addicted to alcohol, and it's sort of unfortunate for the state because I think it's sort of a wrong addiction from a state coffers perspective, but you are definitely addicted to it. And the system that that you have here in the state is actually a very inexpensive system for distribution of product. In the real world out there for distribution of beer and wine, I'll take beer for example, when the brewery manufactures the product and sells it to the wholesaler, by the time the product gets to the wholesaler, the money is already out of the wholesaler's account and in the brewery's hands. It's paid for. There is a requirement of an inventory of anywhere from, say, 20 to 45 days, depending on the season. So the wholesaler is warehousing the product that he or she owns for that period of time before they make the sale. And then they distribute it out. In the state system, the manufacturer sends the product to the state of Oregon, and Oregon never owns the product until it's actually taken out and put into the retail store. What happens is the manufacturer pays for the product to get here. In the beer or wine area, we, the distributor, pay for the product. That's an additional cost. Being the only monopoly, only wholesaler, they pretty much say to the manufacturer, you'll sell it to us at your lowest price, or we don't buy it from you. So they get a great price break. It's stored in the OLCC warehouse, and while OLCC does not charge for storage in that warehouse, it sits in that warehouse. It's the property of the manufacturer, so if it's damaged through no fault of the OLCC, it's the manufacturer's loss, and the OLCC doesn't pay for it. You, the state, don't pay for it until it's taken out and put in the retail store. In the private area, we can't do that. We would love if you mandated that. But I'm sure there will be a few manufacturers out there that would not like that very much. So the cost system is different. What you have right now is pretty, what we believe is consumers complaining because they don't have a lot of retail access to the product. That's really what you have. And OLCC, through their rules, are trying to expand that, and that may or may not be the way you choose to go, and you're the ones who set the policy decision. Most of my distributors would love to be the distributors for the product. We would love to do it. We just can't tell you with a straight face that we could do it any cheaper than you're doing it right now. And it's a great discussion. It would be a better discussion if we were flush with money and you could decide, well, we don't need to take as much from distilled spirits and we can drop it down and make it work over here. But it's a very interesting discussion, but you need to have this discussion. Because overlying this whole thing is something Joe alluded to, which is you don't want something dictated to you in 2014 via the initiative process, if you can help it. And frankly, if somebody's willing to spend $19 million to pass an initiative, we don't have the people in the state of Oregon who are willing to spend anything close to that to try and stop it. So that's why we're at the table to at least discuss what is best for the system and how can something be crafted. But the key element on this thing is the system you now have is a really good system for getting product out there. And your complaints are probably are more along the lines of retail access more than anything else. Your selection is second to none. You have the greatest selection in the country. Any product that you want that's in the sold in the United States, the OLCC will get. It's a great system. There again, we want to be part of the solution. We want to sit with you. We want to talk with you about how to do this stuff. Frankly, we want to sit and talk with the grocers about is there any way we can, you know, come to some agreement on how this stuff is distributed out. We'll know more the legal question in March probably when we get some answers up in Washington State on the single subject question. But the political issue is I'm not sure there's enough money to overcome all the bad-mouthing people have done over the decades about the current system without knowing really what the current system is all about. Again, what you have to understand is alcohol is an addictive product. You're addicted to it, but so is 5 to 10% of the population. So you're not talking about how you best distribute potato chips. You're talking about how you best distribute something that, when consumed or overconsumed, not only hurts you, but can hurt a lot of other people. So those antiquated regulations that are out there are not very antiquated. They actually work. Part of the system, part of the thing that you have with in Oregon is the promotion of small business. The tied house laws, the financial assistance laws, the fact that we can't buy shelf space in the state of Oregon. Frankly, the whole shelf space argument is moot anyway because there's a federal prohibition. No slotting allowances are allowed for any kind of alcohol by the feds. For those of you who don't know, a lot of product is on the shelf in a grocer because they get paid a slotting fee for that. But you can't do that with distilled spirits or beer or wine.
All alcohol.
But there are other ways to try and get on the shelf that we can't do also, which is we can't give credit. Who can give the better credit terms? We can't give quantity discounts. Who would give me a better quantity discount? I'll put you on the shelf better. We can't do a lot of those things. And when you talk to the small brewer, especially in this state, they will tell you that that's the reason why they've been able to prosper, because they can actually get on that shelf without having to give any special deals, because frankly they can't compete against the big guy. When you go to a retail store, a supermarket, you see three manufacturers of cereal, three manufacturers of something. I mean, there's not a bunch of manufacturers. Go to the beer and wine section, you see a ton of manufacturers, most of the local. The reason for that is the law, the system you have in place. Inadvertently, those antiquated laws turned out to be probably the best antitrust laws that were ever invented. Be happy to answer any questions.
Just spell out that last point you just made.
Antitrust? Oh,
okay. No, not the word antitrust.
That was good. Yes, how do you spell it?
You said that the system, how is it that the current system leads to that outcome where we have such a great selection of beer and wine in the grocers?
There's no, Mr. Chair, there's no other incentive to put that product on the shelf other than that product will sell. I can't give you, if you're the grocer, I can't give you any special deals. So if it's Widmer competing with Deschutes, competing with Coors, competing with Budweiser, nobody can give you any special deal legally to get that product on the shelf. You, the grocer, have to make the decision. And what you do is you say, aha, you know, I don't care which one I sell. I'm going to make the same amount of money selling any one of them, or at least within certain categories. So I'm going to try and sell the one the consumer wants the most. That little guy, the cash law, for example, the little guy who self-distributes gets immediate payment for the product. When you're first starting out, that's a huge advantage, which you don't in a lot of other businesses. Mm. In 1994, then Senator Kenemer had the wonderful opportunity to do an interim study on some of the alcohol laws that were out there. And what was very interesting on it is his House co-chair on it was Representative Johnson at the time, I believe, from Southern Oregon, a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, ended up going through, and by the time we finished the whole interim study of the stuff, he introduced a bill that required all consumer products to be sold like beer and wine, because he believed that that was the fairest way to get product to the shelf. We didn't support it. We got blamed. We got yelled at by some people who represented some of the grocers at that time. We had nothing to do with that bill, but that was his reaction to it. So what you find, if you ask any of the small brewers around, the fact that they get payment quickly, the fact that they don't have to compete by giving different kind of terms to get there is a huge benefit for the little guy.
Thanks a lot. Questions for Mr. Romaine? Nothing?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Botkin and Scott Winkles, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we represent the folks who work for the OLCC. I want to take a little different tact. I want to start by thanking Representative Matthews for mentioning the one group that very rarely gets mentioned in these discussions, and that is the victims of overindulgence in alcohol, and sometimes the problems that are associated with that. A lot of the money from liquor sales does go into treatment for alcoholism and associated problems. Not enough, but that's a different discussion for a different committee on a different day. We represent roughly 225 folks at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. 67 of those individuals work in the warehouse, and last year they moved 2.5 million cases of distilled spirits. I challenge anybody to do better than we do. 67 people, 2.5 million cases of distilled spirits. And I do also have to offer sort of a disclaimer here. I have a bit of a conflict of interest. My son delivers alcohol from the OLCC to their retail outlets, and he is one of the, quote, private delivery, part of the private delivery system that helps liquor continue to move, distilled spirits continue to move through our system. We have 43 folks working in enforcement and inspections, and they cover the entire state. Everywhere from Portland to Lakeview to Ontario to Pendleton, and I know most of our members who do this work. They are hardworking and generally just outstanding individuals that I enjoy working with. The distilled spirits system in Oregon costs about $10 million, and we return about $400 million to the general fund. or in profits. And that's about $15 million more this year than we anticipated. So this is a booming business in Oregon, and we need to be cautious that we do not kill the goose that laid the golden egg that Paul referred to. And we would say that ease of access for distilled spirits by responsible consumers is what we would strive for. And I emphasize responsible consumers. You know, I have joked in the halls that, you know, if you're the person who wakes up at 3 in the morning, stretches and says, boy, I really need a drink, you might not be the person we want to be able to find one at 3 in the morning. You know, there are people out there that sort of need to be controlled. We have problem establishments that need to be monitored. It is the duty of our members to make sure that while they're working with local law enforcement, that those establishments are monitored, shut down when appropriate, and lose their license when it's appropriate. Sometimes, I know some legislators are frustrated by the fact that we don't shut them down fast enough. I can tell you that our members share that frustration at times, but everybody deserves their day in court, and we make sure they have one. I feel obligated to say something about the partnership that we have with sort of the small distillers and the liquor agents themselves. We have worked together with the liquor agents and with the small distillers because we sort of all feel like we're the little guys in the process. Sometimes we forget that this system was privatized some 20 plus years ago. And I was looking at the Diaz. I think probably Representative Kennemer may be the only person of equal age to me that he might actually recall getting an OLCC card. Representative Doherty as well. Used to be you had to have an OLCC card and you couldn't drink in Oregon without one. You had to have it until you were 26 years old. And darn, I don't know what happened to mine. But for those of us who've been around Oregon for a long time, we remember sort of the day you got to get your OLCC card and you could actually go into a bar and drink legally. I like Representative Matthews, don't drink hardly at all, rarely. He doesn't drink at all. I drink rarely and not well, so I try to do it in the privacy of my home. We want to be good partners in this. We think, as the union that represents the people who work in the system, we think that there are ways you can, quote, modernize the distribution system. But I think you need to consider the fact that you have partners who have invested time, money, and livelihoods into being your partners up till now. So while you look around for new partners, don't forget those folks who carried you here. And it's important that as we look for opportunities to expand the market, we not eliminate the individual business owners and their employees who are working in the system now and who have sort of brought us along to where we are. And I would submit that that includes our members who work very hard to make sure that the system is a responsible system. And then I want to also say that we need to remember that we have a great craft distilling process business here in Oregon. And I just want to add our voice to everybody else's voice that this is a industry that needs to be helped along and encouraged. With that, I will close and tell you that we're prepared to be productive partners in the discussion, and not obstacles or roadblocks. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Winkles.
Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. And again, Chair Garrett, thank you for allowing me to testify. I hadn't planned on it, but my dear friend Mary convinced me. At any rate, I wanted to maybe share a little bit of how we, the cities, view the current state of alcohol distribution and consumption. I've heard some previous panels and my colleagues talk about the goose that laid the golden egg. I'm not sure what that goose is doing to local governments. Right now, we have in League of Oregon Cities has undertaken two studies, one in 2011 and one in 2007 and 8, I'm sorry, 8 and 9. And we've conclusively shown that cities spend more in dealing with the after effects of irresponsible alcohol consumption than we receive in shared revenue or from any beer and wine tax revenue. Cities make up 63% of the, last I checked, cities has employed 63% of the police officers in the state of Oregon. That number is probably, percentage has gone up probably due to county layoffs, but these are the agencies who are going to deal with increased consumption, the DUIs. One DUI can cost a city police department 8 hours. Most of that's going to be overtime. A DUI, serious injury or fatality DUI collision can cost the city 40 hours of police. Most of that's going to be on overtime. This is a cost that is borne by the cities that we cannot recoup under the current formula. So the cities would request as this goes forward and demand, frankly, that we receive sufficient revenue to deal with the cost of irresponsible alcohol consumption in any change in the distribution privatization discussion. Local governments, we also feel we should have more control in the issuance of licenses. I'm going to share with you some startling numbers from that we've collected from our membership. A 2011 study of our membership, we found 21 problem drinking establishments within the membership. These 21 establishments generated 3,300 emergency calls for service, consuming more than 3,700 hours of officer time. These 21 establishments had 508 assaults. 22 of those were serious assaults, and 76 individuals were arrested for DUI alcohol in those establishments. While the state may bring in money from the sale of alcohol, again, it costs your cities and your counties monies to deal with this. We would also point out that we would like to see the cities to generate some sort of saturation ordinance. We're having these conversations with the OLCC right now to determine when is enough enough. When do we have enough establishments in a given area that we can say this is a problem? There are numerous studies dealing with public health issues, crime, community livability, quality of urban life, from the oversaturation of alcohol serving establishments. We believe
clearly you're talking about on premises consumption, right? You're not getting
AI,
the issue.
Some of the problem establishments can have off premise sales, but this is we're looking at the totality of circumstances for cities. For the alcohol impact area issue, predominantly we're looking at off premise sales licenses.
Okay.
And again, cities would also like to see the ability to designate alcohol impact areas. We have seen there's been some success with voluntary compliance in parts of Portland dealing with establishments that have been selling fortified wines and curbing those. We would like to see that established in statute where we would have the ability to limit certain types of alcohol, the fortified beverages, from sale. And with that, I'm eager for your questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Matthews.
So would the league oppose privatization of the alcohol sales then, or are you in favor? Where's the league's position on that?
Chair Garrett, Representative Matthews, the league's position is that if this conversation goes forward on privatization, we would like to see our principles adopted in whatever comes out of that process, that include local control, ensure that our costs are met, ensure that we have control over those licenses, ensure that we have the ability to have more control over the quality of our life in our cities.
Follow up.
So when you say cost control, almost like a clawback to a business so that you can pay the overtime you suggested of the DWE or the, you know, accident, is that what you're thinking? What are your costs associated?
Chair Garrett, Representative Matthews, I think when we look at the cost, we know, you know, we can track how much we're bringing in liquor and shared revenue and from beer and wine tax revenue. What we would like to see is that number close to what we expend. I'm not talking about going after that business. That seems inefficient, but I'm talking about a tax rate or a revenue sharing rate that is equal to what we're spending in addressing these issues.
Yeah, just briefly, I guess it's going to require more discussion on my end to try to figure out. I mean, we're going to assume that if alcohol involved, that was the cause of the collision, or we're going to assume. I mean, we're talking about costs associated with the involvement of public safety or the involvement of city resources. Is that really what we're talking about here?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, we'll just have to try to find a way to draw a line. I come from a world in public safety where we're called and we respond. You know, I've not been on a fire ground yet where I took a clipboard and asked somebody to fill out the following information for contact and credit. I've not done that. So I'd like to try to figure out how we could do that. But also, I'm respectful, as you know, 361,000 out in Gresham. We have a tough time paying for public safety. So I'd like to have that conversation with you offline. Thank you.
Chair Garrett, Representative Matthews, in the DUI interview that takes place when someone is hooked up, they part of the interview is determine where they were drinking, so we can determine the establishment. And in the police reporting procedure, most police agencies are noting on the report alcohol involvement.
That's so, very interesting. So I was only a cop 11 years. I appreciate that insight. Thank you.
Representative Kemmerer.
Mary, I wanted to go back to numbers. This flyer I got said there are only 67 OLCC employees. I guess that's the ones that are actually in the warehouse.
Yes.
And then you have 43 in enforcement.
Right.
So that leaves 136.
Who do the privileged tax collection. We have people who monitor accounts receivables and payables. I mean, we have accounting and...
I'm sure. I just was trying to understand what it all was. Okay.
Right. I just referred to strictly warehouse and inspections because that seemed to be sort of what we were talking about was how to... We seem to be focused on the distribution of liquor rather than the consequences of liquor abuse.
Okay, thank you both.
Thank you, sir.
I think we have a little, I know that Judy Cushing is here and would like to testify, and is there anyone else who's here who was not on the list but would like to speak on this issue today? Judy.
Chair Garrett, Chair Kennemer, and members of the committee. I really didn't intend to testify this afternoon, but I feel compelled.
Your name for the record.
Oh, my name? My apologies. My name is Judy Cushing. I am CEO of Oregon Partnership, a statewide nonprofit providing alcohol and drug crisis intervention services 24 hours a day and prevention education to kids and adults. I didn't really intend to testify, but I kind of felt compelled to bring another perspective to you this afternoon, and I will do so very briefly. I have a feeling I stand between you and adjournment, and you've been very patient in listening to some important testimony from various perspectives on this issue. I very much appreciate appreciated Representative Hoyle's comments earlier about the system that Oregon has, the system that New Hampshire has, and the fact that our control system in this state really is working, and it's a very, very important system to retain. I come to you from a perspective of prevention and intervention. We work closely with fire and rescue and police on our crisis lines and our military helpline, and we know firsthand what the testimony you just heard about what cities and jurisdictions are dealing with related to alcohol problems. We know that a small percentage of the population drink a much larger percentage of the liquor, and the more available that liquor is to that population, the more problems you're going to have. There's a lot of research. Several years ago, I had the honor of serving on the Institute of Medicine's panel to study underage drinking, and I was amazed at the research around not only the causes and the factors around underage drinking, but the fact that the number of alcohol outlets has a direct correlation to the problems in the community and the availability of alcohol to young people. The minute we open the door to many more outlets, the more problems we're going to have, and we'll have a more significant problem with underage childhood and teen drinking. And if you don't know, the average age of first drink for a young male is 11.5 years. And the average age of first drink for a young girl is 12 years. Oregon, unfortunately, has a drinking rate among our eighth graders of twice the national average, and our student wellness survey shows that our kids are getting alcohol mainly from family and friends. But I'm here to tell you, if alcohol is available in grocery stores and other outlets in their neighborhoods, they're going to get it there. I will tell you, for the most part, young people do not get their distilled spirits from our liquor stores, because our liquor store owners are diligent about who they sell their alcohol to. So the system, in terms of preventing availability to young people around distilled spirits, is working very well. I also want to bring to your attention some trends that you may or may not know. We're certainly hearing a lot about addiction and problems with alcohol in the news these days, but young women are drinking distilled spirits at much, much higher rates than they used to. And when I'm talking young women, I'm talking middle school and high school teen girls. If you look in magazines and on the internet where young girls are being attracted to anything from clothing and styles to foods and particularly alcohol, we know there's a center at Johns Hopkins University called the Center on Alcohol Marketing and Youth, and they've done extensive studies around what's driving youth drinking and in the media. And the industry has become very smart around that, just like they did around Joe Camel. And young women, if you look at a magazine today or on the internet, it's a sexy, fun, happening thing to have a martini glass in your hand. That is influencing. It's directly influencing young drinking among young girls today. The more available we make distilled spirits in our state, the more problems we're going to have, and we'll pay for years to come in our workforce, in our education system, and in our communities. I really, really implore you to consider thoughtfully the full discussion around privatization. I represent Oregon Partnership here, but I also serve on the Governor's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. While I'm not representing their voice here, I hope you will consider maintaining our control state and the availability of distilled spirits to our young people. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I guess not. I guess that's it for our witnesses. I want to thank everybody for coming on relatively short notice. I think we only got the word out yesterday that we wanted to take this up again. I guess I would just say before we leave that both Co-Chair Cameron and I believe this is an issue that we do need to take up. It seems like this privatization discussion is going to happen. That's been made clear. And you know, it was also said today that the legislature is the policymaking body, and that means we need to be involved in that discussion. And so I would hope that as the OLCC continues its rulemaking proceedings, we are able to have a discussion with you about how that fits into the broader discussion that needs to have around this topic. And if you'd like to step forward again, Mr. Farrow, and address that briefly, please, I'd be happy to hear from you.
Mr. Chair, and if I could, I think we're probably talking about both the larger issue of privatization and modernization.
Mr. Chair, once again for the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of the Oregon Liquor Commission. I think there's been a lot of great testimony here today. It's very important to listen to all those different sources. We certainly would always want to engage with the legislature to talk about whatever you may want to talk about. The commissioners would certainly endorse that. The thing that today we started off about the two particular rules, but it certainly morphed to a much broader, more complex question. And that's something that I think that a lot of people may have questions about. The commission, I feel very lucky. I have a very good, great professional staff that works at the commission. I feel very fortunate that our agents, they do an excellent job for the state out there. And I don't think either of those points should be taken lightly in terms of how we move forward and whatever we may choose to do. You know, there was talk about privatization and 1183. And my dad used to go ahead and lecture me a lot in my impetuous youth. He said, "Stephen, you may want to wait to see if the other guy's parachute opens up before you jump out of the plane." And so as we move forward, that's certainly something to take into account. When we look at what may or may not happen in Washington, one thing that you want to remember is Washington, under 1183, becomes the most deregulated state in the entire nation. And that's a pretty significant change. So whatever course of action Oregon chooses to take, and I think there's great discussion to be had about that, I think the commission and its agents will prove that we do an excellent job for the state. We certainly are concerned about oversaturation out there. That's one of the reasons why we would not, even with these new rules moving forward, there would not be a proliferation of stores out there. So I do very much appreciate the opportunity and time before this committee, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. That will conclude the informational meeting, and there is no further business. We're adjourned.